Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. Got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr. And with us today, for the first time, won't be the last, it better not be, we have Dr. Sean Wharton. He is a Canadian doctor. Oh, Canada. He is, and we just told him he's sexy as hell. He's trying to change his camera, and he's actually a prolific doctor, clinician and researcher, clinical trialist. Been following his work since I think I went to like an OMA or it was like the ASBP. I think you presented with
when you were a student,
Sharma.
And I was there. Yeah,
long
I'm
time
surprised
ago.
We didn't get to hang out when we got to hang out with Dr. Sharma.
Oh, I can't believe that you guys remember that. That was such a long time.
Yeah, it was a long.
The question I got asked in that during that that session, somebody said, "How long did it take you to grow your dreads?"
Because they were like, "That's amazing."
I was talking about cardiovascular disease and obesity and the connection and is it real? And they were on about my dreads. I'm like, "Yeah, let's talk about it, man." That's a better question than science.
You must have been just out of like fellowship or training or something. Because I remember were you training under Dr. Sharma or something?
Yes, I was. Sharma was my mentor. He was still in Canada at the time, and now he's gone, and I'm kind of the lead here. But I had just it was probably maybe 2 to 3 years out of my fellowship and starting in obesity medicine space.
That is so cool. So the reason we brought Dr. Wharton on, he's been in multiple of these studies that we've talked about. One of which we want to talk about that was just presented at the ADA, he presented it, the Step Up trial, where they used a higher dose of semaglutide. Everybody knows Wegovy, we talk about all the time. They cranked up the dose, like tripled the dose, and looked what happened in those with obesity. And then there's some other really cool trials he's been involved with. We want to kind of pick his brain. So welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a real, it's a pleasure to be here, really, to be able to chat with you guys, because I usually get just the media interviews that are a little bit boring, a little bit dry, but it's really nice to have like a real scientific talk and a realistic one.
We are not dry, we're wet as hell.
Let it loose. Yeah, let it loose, have fun, and keep it educational. Yeah, Spencer is a wet. Good Lord.
So, okay, let's first talk. We could get into your background. I think that's always boring when people talk about, what do you do? How'd you get to where you are? We could do that. You're awesome. You're prolific. People trust us that is the case. I want to talk about how you got involved with the Step Up trial. How did this even come to play?
Yeah, so I guess the concept of the Step Up trial is that, you know, the question is 2.4 milligrams enough? Of a dose. Was that the top dose? Where do they get that from? A lot of times we land on in these trials and we don't know where the background was. Like there's people obviously who are doing basic science research and a whole bunch of other research in the background who make the decisions on what the titrations are going to look like, what the maximum dose is. They're doing area under the curve, pharmacokinetics, pharmacodynamic studies. And that's what happens. And then we just do the actual study. Sometimes they aren't exact, or sometimes they learn more as they go along. So they landed on 2.4. So initially, we have to remember that semaglutide, the first trial that I did was we use it as a daily dose. We did it the same way liraglutide. Yeah. We did 0.4 milligrams every day. And that was a phase 2 trial. And I was on the publication for that. Then they announced to us that we're going to be using it monthly. I'm like, weekly, they're going to be using it weekly. I'm like, but we didn't do a phase 2 weekly trial. We've never done it weekly before. Where'd you come up with that from? And what dose did you come up with? So they did pharmacokinetic modeling and they multiplied the dose. And they came up with this weekly dose and we started our phase 3 trials with weekly without ever doing a phase 2 weekly. So that was a jump.
Yeah, and in fact,
really cool.
That trial, I've ever since you published that. I have used that as part of my, when I give talks on the medications to other doctors, I use that specific slide of all the different doses that you had, because it compared it to liraglutide.
Yes,
right. If I'm not mistaken, that, you know, and yep, and so it gives a good idea of, and I always kind of introduce it as, well, this was kind of the dosing trial, sort of. And yep, then I said, and yada yada yada, they ended up with weekly. So there you go. Yeah, all right, now I learned a little bit of the background.
That's really cool.
And so, and that's where they kind of tend to learn as they go, and they want to make it a little bit faster. So, and if it passes the FDA, if it go, you go to the FDA and the EMA and say, can we do this trial? Because you have to ask before you can actually even do it. Is our research solid enough that this will be safe to go to ethics and be able to put it through? So safe enough for them to go to ethics, it made sense. Their pharmacokinetic modeling made sense, and that's how they got the weekly dose. Now let's go to this triple dose, because it's three times the dose. So they've got to do the same thing. They've got to go, oh, I think it may work. Let's look at the kinetic models, and then let's take it to ethics. And ethics and FDA has to say, this is okay to do a trial on. It makes sense. And what they did was they took a look at the area under the curve, which is a pharmacokinetic. I did my doctorate in pharmacy before going into medicine. So I love kinetics and dynamics. So
I was going to say, it all makes sense now.
Now it makes sense.
Because
I am a pharmacist and academic pharmacist doing kinetics. So I really like that stuff. So what they did was they looked at the oral semaglutide molecule. They went from 14 milligrams, obviously, up to 25 and then 50 milligrams. That jump from 14 to 25, there was three times the actual dose of the area under the curve, which is the exposure. From that, they were able to understand that you could go to three times the actual dose in intravenous, because we're just looking at the amount of semaglutide within the bloodstream. So the oral to IV should be to the subcutaneous, the injection should be relatively similar. And that was information that was given at the ADA. Like when I spoke about it at the ADA, people asked, how did you get three times? And it was from the oral studies that they went to the FDA and said,
interesting.
This.
Wow. Okay.
But what about, so because they saw that they tolerated it, cause I'm sitting there going like, how did they assume that they're going to tolerate this? Okay. Just because of the area under the curve and they tolerated it with the oral?
Correct.
Wow.
Amazing.
That was about it. And it was worth, it was a good enough question and a good enough science that the FDA and the EMA and the other bodies that decide on can you do clinical trial said, this is reasonable.
That is amazing. Okay.
That's great to know. Because we generally know a lot of this stuff and we're like, so how did they come up with this? Like, that, you know, all right, well, how the heck
did it? There you have it, everyone.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, so what was the study design?
So the study design looked the exact same as, and it's good that we're doing this after the ADA, right?
Yeah.
Because I presented all this stuff.
Yeah, they kick you off.
We've already been in trouble in the past for that.
My brother did something on an embargo thing, and he got in big trouble.
Yeah, so the good news is we're not.
I swear to God, we didn't say anything that was anyways, whatever.
I know it's so tight. So we are, of course, we have the embargoes and et cetera, but whatever we've said at the presentation, whatever we have published at the ADA is good, but there's stuff in the publication that still is in the
imperfect state.
But this is stuff that we said and we showed the actual graph. So the actual titration schedule is the same as every semaglutide study. Every 4 weeks, we end up going up in dose. And the only difference was the last titration went from 2.4 all the way up to 7.2. So it was that one big jump. Four
That's
weeks to 2.4, and then up to 7.2. There's no titration in the middle. Hence the terminology step up. But it really was a step up.
That's a leap up.
A leap up trial.
Yeah. That's one small step for a pen, but one giant leap for a semaglutide dose there.
Oh yeah, wine shot. No? You're saying semaglutide. We always say semaglutide. Novo Nordisk told me it was semaglutide. Are you just
semaglutide? Oh well, I don't know. Semaglutide.
Maybe it's just. Is it just tomato tomato? What's going
on here? I think so. I think it's Canadians and how we say out and about.
Out and about.
You know what? That's right. Actually funny because doesn't South Park have a Canadian origin of some sort? And they were definitely talking about semaglutide.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. See, okay. I'm doing it the Canadian way. I don't mind being Canadian.
Canadian. All right. Okay. So the comparator group 7.2 versus 2.4. Is that right?
Correct. 7.2 versus 2.4 versus the placebo, and it was a 5:1:1 ratio.
Okay.
And people asked that question as well. That got brought up in my session. Why 5:1:1? And it was to take a look at the safety profile. To a large degree, a lot of times you're hoping that the efficacy is good, but to have enough of the exposure to see both things, really the enough to see that the efficacy was real and it was better, and that the safety profile was also there. And the important thing is that if there's enough power to compare the 5:1:1, then everything's okay. Because I guess people were wondering, I don't know, could you do 5:3:3 or 1:1:1? No, we want more in the 7.2. And if the power is good enough to compare, then everything's good.
You're good. Okay. So what were the main findings of this one that you can, that you're allowed to tell us?
Yeah. Again, what we presented is that with the 7.2 milligram, there was greater weight loss and not that much greater a side effect profile. That was the bigger deal. So so the in ballpark figures, the step one trial showed about a 15.6 per percent loss. And here we're seeing about an 18. So it was a jump to about 18. And then if you go to the efficacy estimate, you're almost at the 21% range. So you're going past that 20 range for the efficacy estimate, or the trial product estimate is what we sometimes call.
Can you explain that? Because that we've done it before, but it's always good because
So well, especially for
only us, but everybody out there, because it's a newer concept a little bit in the studies over the past few years, and it's easier said than done to explain.
Absolutely. So that's why we wrote an article on it back in the day. So estimands are essentially just math. So the word estimand should be equated to mathematical calculations. So back in the day, we used to just take someone who dropped out of a study, and with weight management, tons of people dropped out. So in the early 90s and in the early 2000s, we'd see the dropout rates of 50%. So if someone drops out and they took it for 4 weeks, do you take that last value when they last dropped out of their weight, or do you just get rid of them totally? Who cares? And don't even use any of their values because they weren't there long enough. Or so what do you do? And that was back in the day of intention to treat or the completer and analysis. And intention to treat and completer analysis just wasn't good enough. It just didn't help us. What they then did was say, mathematically, that person stayed in, we can figure out what they would look like at the end of the trial based on whether people left and then went on a medication that was better, left and went to bariatric surgery. So those things are called intercurrent events that would throw the person off, or them stopping and going on to something better. So with all of that mathematical calculation, you can take everybody to the end of the actual trial. You take them to the end of a trial in two different ways. Taking the end of the trial in the way that the intercurrent event was there, that they stopped, they went on something different, they thought they're on placebo, they were mad. So that is kind of like the ITT. That's where we get the 15% weight loss in the step one. And then the intention to treat analysis. And then the completers analysis would be the efficacy estimate, where they're taking it exactly as indicated, again, mathematically, but all the way to the end at the right dose, at the right titration schedule. And that's where we get the 17%. Mm-hmm. So it's always a little bit more. But as we get less and less dropout, those numbers become closer.
tighter together. If there was a ton of dropout, those numbers are a little bigger. So that's what estimand means. And I think it's a much better mathematical calculation. I'm really pleased that they actually did it. And I like the treatment policy estimand or the trial product estimand better. If it would be taken the way it should be taken, that's what we want to know. But people take it any way they want to. So we're never going to use those numbers. People will stop it. They don't have enough money. They So I just want to know exactly, does a drug work in the way it's supposed to work? What would I normally get? And then I'll deal with my patient by myself.
Yeah, so 21. We're talking about 21%. We're close to the tirzepatide like numbers.
Yes, exactly. It was getting close to the tirzepatide numbers.
Are you allowed to talk about this? So I did an advisory board for the Redefine, the CagriSema, and that alone looked like similar to, you know, tirzepatide. But now with this higher dose of semaglutide, whatever you want to call it, to me it would be like, all right, well then we can crank it up clearly and start getting more out of this. So it feels like the Redefine might be antiquated already.
Yeah, so I mean, because they presented
We can talk about Redefine after that. Go ahead.
Yeah, we'll keep on moving on with the side effects. Because that was one of the big things, right? People are like, okay, great. You're going to get more efficacy. Hopefully you will. But what about the side effects? Are they going to be worse? So when we did that step up, that's when we saw an increase in the GI side effects. So there was more GI side effects, but it wasn't a huge jump. It wasn't a triple jump. It wasn't like this massive jump, which we may be seeing with some other meds that may be coming out. We've seen some phase 2 data with some pretty high rates of nausea and some other things that's already been published. So this wasn't that bad, and it was mitigated after that 7.2. After you got up there, then it did the exact same thing it always does. It gradually ends up getting better and better and better. It didn't seem to be the problematic issue. That certainly wasn't a major issue.
That's pretty cool. I mean, to me, this gives, amazing. If they can just get it cheaper, it gives an option of more efficacy, I guess, effectiveness, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Or is the problem going to be that then, you know, you got to manufacture it. It's three times as much volume and it, you know, who knows?
And that's the big thing. And I know nothing about that part because I don't, you know, I don't work for Novo Nordisk and et cetera. So I don't know what the pen is going to look like. I don't know how you get to three times the actual dose. So those logistical issues, I really like the science and the research behind it. Like what we were able to show, the practicality of what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. But I think they did this for a reason, knowing that they can do it. I don't think they'd spend this much time and effort without knowing that they could put it into a pen and deliver it properly and maybe at a competitive price. I'm guessing at all of this stuff, but I can't see it being out of reach. Because why would they do all this effort?
For anybody listening, oral semaglutide is being submitted for FDA approval, hopefully by the end of the year, for this higher dose of oral semaglutide for weight specifically, as opposed to Rybelsus. Not that effective for weight loss, although people use it. Some people respond really well at the lower doses. They're cranking up the dose in oral to hopefully have an effect, and we don't know anything about costs there, but that it's good to have all these different options.
Yeah options and, are good,
so we're hopeful.
I preach about that. I preach about and speak about it oftentimes, because coming from a minority group, a disadvantaged group, a marginalized group, we know that those groups are frequently ones that need the medications more than others do. And being in Canada, the Indigenous population is our group here in Canada that are marginalized and lower socioeconomic income. I mean, others are too, people of color, but the Indigenous are our problem, and in America, it's Black people that are your problem, not the indigenous as much. You have them, but the focus is, you know, the tension on Black and the Hispanic groups. So certainly the hope is that getting to those populations is what all of this is heading towards, is being able to make it accessible.
As opposed to the rich folk in Hollywood using it for small amounts of vanity weight loss with no clinical meaning. That would be the key. That would be nice. Yeah. Okay. You've done clinical trials or working on other clinical trials of other peptides, molecules, GLP-1/GIP, glucagon. What other agonists are you working on? What are you shilling for now?
So I won't say all the things I'm working on. I more so want to say what are the things that are out there, things that are coming, right? We know that there's a number of great molecules, and they're all in clinical trials. So if you're a clinical trialist, you're likely, hopefully, you got some of these clinical trials. And I'm a clinical trialist, so I'm always hoping to get the clinical trials phase 1, 2, 3. I will take them. The dual agonists, both with the glucagon connected to it and the GLP-1, and the triple agonist, glucagon and GIP, and then the antagonist. I mean, what's up with that? GIP antagonist. So we're fascinated by it, but it just goes to show you that we don't really understand all the details here as to what happens, but you just mess with that receptor enough and get it to maybe antagonize, but then agonize because of the antagonistic issue, that it gets angry and it says, oh, let me start working a little bit more. Maybe those are some of the ways that all of this is working.
That's so cool. Which drug are you most excited about? Is there anyone in particular that you're like, this one's going to change? To me, it's going to be the triple agonist. I've had patients in the trials, mm-hmm. and I've had to, then they come to me and they're like, I can't get my retatrutide. You probably call it retatrutide.
Retatrutide.
I call it retatrutide. I've had those patients come to me and then I have to put them on tirzepatide mm-hmm. and they're always like, this doesn't even hold a candle. I'm like, man, tirzepatide is the best we got. And it doesn't mm-hmm. even hold a candle. So I'm like, holy cow, what is this stuff going to do? So I'm always interested I'm excited about it because I think the metabolic effects are going to be insane.
Yeah, so I'm excited about the new molecules in terms of all the research that they're going to do, because glucagon tends to work in the liver. I think that whole fatty liver world is going to be a big deal. So you've got the dual agonist with the GLP-1 and the glucagon, but you've got the triple agonist. And then you have to look at how much activity each of those is mm-hmm. giving, like how much activity is glucagon giving, so you don't get the hyperglycemia. So it can't be too much activity, but enough activity that the fatty acid oxidation and the lipolysis is actually happening to get rid of those fat cells. So that's what you kind of want. You want no hyperglycemia. You don't want the glucagon pushing up the actual sugar, but you want it doing all the actual positive things. As much as I'm excited about the different molecules, I spend time in different countries talking to people and looking at what they actually have. And I'm just excited about more molecules getting onto the market to try to be able to get more molecules. Maybe even the molecules that we are not using as much here in the first world, in America and in Canada, within the UK, maybe getting some of those other molecules, even liraglutide, over to those other worlds, those emerging markets. There are huge numbers of people in Brazil, in Malaysia, in the Polynesian Islands. I mean, Brazil is a massive country, and there's likely going to be a lot of use of things that we are not we are excited about, but I would just like to see more availability around the entire world.
You're a man of the people. That's good. No, that's great. Yeah. Accessibility. Just, I think at some point, just so many people are going to be having benefit from these, and even if they're the older generation versions, like you said, they can still have benefit. The one that, you know, how did you get into the clinical trials anyway? How does that work? You just study to do it, and then do you have your own clinic that you
yeah so a lot of people, what they do is they have their own clinic, their weight management clinic, and in the back, the last two rooms in their clinic, they decide to run some clinical trials out of there. They have a coordinator, clinical trials coordinator, and then the patients that are coming through the clinic, if any of them can't afford a medication or they fit a trial criteria, then you're like, okay, are you interested in doing clinical trials? I know you can't go on to the GLP-1, you don't have enough money, but if you fit the criteria, you could go into a clinical trial. And then you have to, the setup is a lot because you need to take blood work from the patients. You have to spin it yourself. You can't just give it to a local lab where you would go get blood work done. You've got to send it off to California over here in Canada, or send it to some central lab in Quebec, another province. So you're FedExing DHLing and you're having dry ice that comes in and to keep everything. So you need to have a phlebotomist, a lab person, and then you need to just be really precise with each patient, and it can be really challenging, but really fun, because then when you're speaking on stage, you can actually speak from the standpoint of, I do these trials, I don't know any of the results because everything is blinded, but I actually am there and see what happens on the actual ground floor. And I start to do that mainly just to be in the know, So I knew what was coming out. Initially it was a lot, it was expensive to set up, et cetera. So it wasn't about the financial aspect. It was more about knowing what was in the field.
Yeah. You're scientifically curious of how it works. I think it's so cool. And how do you,
I just got kicked off the internet for about 5 minutes. Yeah, so now you got to repeat everything you just said.
No, we're talking about how he got into clinical trials. So I'm are you at an academic center, or did you have this your private practice that you do this through?
That's interesting. So that's the bit of the Sean Wharton story. So we all start out at academic centers, right? We're residents, and we're doing our academic medicine and residency. And then I got asked to continue on as an academic, to be in that hierarchical structure. And I didn't want to be in the ivory tower. I said, I'll make my own clinic. And this is a very non-Canadian thing to do. It's a very American thing to do, but it's not Canadian. I'll start my own clinic, and in my own clinic, I'm going to start my own clinical trials section, which will be a community-based clinical trials, which you know is harder to start up than the academic one, which has all this money from funders and the government and everything else. I got to do my own. I got to put my own money in, get my own spinners, my own fridges and freezers and dry ice. I got to do it all, and I kind of felt that with the academic world, I wasn't able to make changes as quickly as I actually wanted to. I wanted to be in charge. I didn't want to be told. I didn't want my money taken from me, and then they give part of it back to me every month. Here's a little bit of all that work that you did. I wanted to do well on my own or fail on my own. Either way, I was going to do it myself. Fail by myself, or like do well by myself.
You sound like a gunsling American over there.
God,
I like it, and I think that's I'm a little different than the rest of the Canadians.
I love it.
Yeah, so that's how we started it up. So I'm still with the academic centers. I'm an adjunct professor and assistant professor because of all my publications and all my academia, and I do work with the university residents, etc. But when it comes to clinical trials, I wanted to run it and not have it go through
university. Is it just like who you know on how you got to be like the number one author on these big clinical trials? That's like a big deal.
I think it's the integrity of the clinic that I run as well that really helps it, right? My motto hasn't changed from 2008. We opened our doors May 1st, 2008, with the intention of servicing people who are marginalized. So we only take OHIP dollars, Ontario Health, funding. So I don't take any cash. I have no way of asking people for cash. In America, that's what you absolutely have to do. You have to be able to generate, because you don't have the system that we do in a sense. But I just work on on government funding, which means I get very little amounts of money for every patient who comes through. So I have to be very efficient, and the clinic never has made money, right? I mean, everybody knows that. We're on the edge every month. Like, are we going to fail this month? Are we going to fail next month? Yeah. But
well, that's not so different than here in America, because the insurance companies hate to pay us. That's why Spencer just makes everyone pay him cash every month. And I'm trying
cash
to
money
martyr
cash that, money.
Trying not to go out of business.
Right. You know, so I just really wanted to try to make sure that anyone who had the ability to access it could access it based on the fact that they didn't have to pay for it. They could do it through government funding. So whether you were the Prime Minister of Canada or you were the person who was on the low socioeconomic status, anyone could come to the clinic and be able to access it and get a level of care that was based in science. And I've kept that for all the years and all the government changes and all the mishaps. So, and everybody knows that that's the essence of the actual clinic. I think that propels the rest of the world and the academic world to say that, you know, based on that and based on some other things that we see, we think that he can lead some of this research. And when they have to think about, when I get up on stage, what do I sound like? What is it? How does it feel? What does it look like? I think they're making all of those calls when they make a decision on who's going to represent them.
You're a cool dude, man. I love it.
Yeah.
Good guy.
Well, I have a couple other questions, though, Spencer, because something else you published recently. Now, I know you weren't the lead author on this, but everyone's very interested in, you know, the different types of intermittent fasting and all these things. So recently in the BMJ, you and a host of others, including our friend Arya Sharma, were authors on a meta-analysis of randomized controlled trials of intermittent fasting strategies, their effects on weight, and some metabolic risk factors. Now, we've talked on this podcast a lot how the body of evidence, if we look at all the studies overall, it's just another tool as a means to change the energy intake, create an energy deficit, help with weight reduction. But, you know, I know you obviously helped out with this publication, but you know what one I'm talking about?
Yeah, and I'm not sure that I was, if I was one of the authors on it, I don't remember all the details of it, but I've published on intermittent fasting, so I definitely know with our own patients we've done it and with some other academic trials. So I'll be able to speak to it even if I wasn't on that trial.
Well, let's see. Hold on.
I was.
Hold on. You, Department of Medicine, McMaster University, Hamilton, yeah. Ontario, Canada?
Yeah, that's you. Is me.
There's no other Sean Wharton professor. Ed, right in front of Arya Sharma.
In front of Arya's name. Okay.
Yeah, you must. I mean, and I know there are a lot of authors on this, and it probably took, you know, a lot of different little sections, and you probably gave some thoughts on it. But I mean, the bottom line, this was literally just published a month ago,
right.
And it does conclude, you know, at the end, what we've always felt was the body of evidence that essentially, it's the same thing as, you know, direct continuous energy restriction. Mm-hmm. But and so that is the bottom line up front. Mm-hmm. But it is a tool. And a lot of people like to do these different types of fasting to help create an energy deficit. And I always tell people they can combine it with any of the other little dietary changes we make on a personalized basis. But I thought, yeah, getting your thoughts on it, since obviously you've been involved with these things.
Yeah. Yeah. So I believe in the science. I believe a lot of times that these trials go back to basic science. You're doing a clinical research study, but it helps to explain the basic science. I believe in intermittent fasting basic science, that it does more to the telomeres and to the genetic structure of than the mitochondria. I believe that it does good stuff on that micro level, and likely on the macro level, if you could do it long enough in our obesogenic society, right? Mm-hmm. I just believe that if you were living with obesity or living with struggles and you could do intermittent fasting, you would live longer. I believe that there's multiple other things that stop you from doing intermittent fasting on a regular basis, or doing a ketogenic style dietary measure on a regular basis. So I believe the science always tells us that it's helpful, and then I believe the practical or the preaching of it alienates people and disconnects people and divides people and causes a problem. That's where I run into the difficulty. I mean, it happens in other spaces as well. It happens in a religious space and everything else. The preaching mm-hmm. is the problem. I just don't believe that intermittent fasting is great if you're a surgeon, if you're rich, if you have capacity. If you're doing great, mm-hmm. and your telomeres are going to be longer, and your genetics are going to be better, and your mitochondria is going to work better, and all that stuff is going to be great, and you can do it for longer, for years, as opposed to a week. So mm-hmm. I think the science is great, the practicality is difficult, and the religious preaching is divisive and biased and abusive.
Yeah, that's what we see. And that's unfortunately a lot of people out there that get into these things. They have whatever biases and they claim, oh, it's the only way and it's the magical way and all this stuff. I mean, I know people have paid a lot of money for some books that make that claim out there. And those people have made a lot of money by, having these substantial claims. And there's always a little bit of truth. There's always some science to it. And then they go to the extreme. But yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. Thank you.
Jason Fung lives around the corner from us.
I love how he knew who I was talking about there.
Yeah, right away. I mean, it's funny. Yeah. I'm doing a talk in Turkey or something like that, and somebody gets something on and goes, "Do you know Jason Fung? Because we want to talk about that." And I'm like, "Oh my God, please don't talk about that."
Don't bring it.
Jason and I have talked. We've done talks at similar times or whatever else. And I believe in what Jason's doing. I just don't believe in the preaching. My way or the
zealotry.
Yeah.
The zealotry. Yep. That's awesome.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you. I'd love to have you back on for all the new clinical trials that you're working through and presenting. Definitely. I just love how you got into the clinical trial thing, and you're helping so many people doing it along the way. And you're just a good guy. So thanks for coming on.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
Yeah. And helping those of us, you know, on the front lines and also, you know, developing clinical guidance for other doctors. So you really help us teach others, not just patients, but other physicians and stuff. So
yeah, you
very
wrote,
much appreciate it.
You write the Canadian guidelines for obesity. I'm pretty sure.
You were in on that with Aria and all everybody.
I was the lead on that. Yeah. You were so the that guy. Was a big deal. I was the guy. And I remember Aria giving me a call in 2016 saying, "Sean, I think you should do the guidelines. We said that we weren't going to do guidelines, but I think it's time. We need to do it. And you need to actually lead it." And I'm like, "What?" And I'm like, "Okay, you know what? I can do that. But are you, you're," and he goes, "I can't do it. Can't do it.
He's done. He's like, "I'm retiring. I'm done. I'm out of here."
We're going to have to tell Dr. Wharton about our hanging out with Dr. Sharma sometime. Dr. Sharma.
We almost accosted him in a hotel. We basically surrounded him like, "Hey, Dr. Sharma, what's up?" And he was like, "What's going on?" He was like,
we were like little fanboys, you know?
He was a bit flustered. He's like, "What is the—"
But I'm sure he was there for you guys to party with if you get the opportunity.
Oh yeah,
that is definitely.
Oh yeah,
we have some pictures out with him.
Yeah, great. He went out.
Great, he was a mentor that definitely was able to help me to understand a little bit of the balance, but also understanding where to bring the science and the academic nature of and gave encouragement. For me to move forward in the different ways, right? I mean, I didn't move forward. Aria was in the ivory tower, stayed with the university setting because he came from Germany and then came over to Canada. And in Canada, you had to stay within that academic setting. I was able to go into the community setting and have that more of the entrepreneurial, the American approach. I want to do it by myself, pull myself up by my own bootstraps.
Love it.
Fail or do I'm well. And he encouraged that. He was right there and helped me to be me and to understand all of his mentoring. He didn't preach one specific way. And that's what I do with a lot of the people who come in and around me and work in my clinic. They branch off And it's amazing. And they do awesome. I'm like, I wanted you to stay working for me, but I also love the fact that you've branched off and you're doing this amazing thing. And I can send patients to you because you do women's health in a way that I don't understand, because you do metabolics and different things in a way that that I can send people to you. It's so nice to have the different viewpoints.
You're the man. Well,
awesome.
We appreciate you. I don't know if you're on Twitter, where we got to send people for your social media. You don't do as much social media.
Not as much. I do Instagram. I have a Dr. Sean Wharton. So DrSeanWharton at at that. And so you can look at some stuff, but because I'm so much doing the publications and I've kind of pushed back from that a bit because there is a lot of specific things I can't speak about. So I've got to uphold all of those aspects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if I'd be able to do that, cause I'm just a town crier. I'd be
you almost got fired from everything you've ever done because of that.
Yeah. So. I've gotten in trouble quite a bit.
Yeah. I was always in trouble.
That's why I gotta have my own business. Otherwise I'd get fired.
Right on.
Thanks so much for having on. Here's our outro, everyone. Send this to anybody who is interested in the higher doses of semaglutide/semaglutide. And send this to friends, family, whoever else. Thank you, everyone.
Cheers.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
Great.